Morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. This week, the Robert W. Deutsch Foundation has convened two groups of emerging arts leaders for workshops around the idea of undoing racism. Trainers from the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond explore how institutional racism has come to be so firmly ensconced in American culture and what it'll take to get rid of it. My guests are Kimberly Richards from the People's Institute and A. Adar Ayira, a local artist and poet who's on the advisory board of Baltimore Racial Justice Action. What is the impact of individual behavior on advancing or attenuating bigotry in institutions across the spectrum of American life? How can racism be undone? Then, Baltimore author Jessica Anya Blau tells us about her new novel, The Trouble with Lexi, and Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. This has been an extraordinary and unprecedented political season. Republicans are close to choosing as their standard bearer a man who has been widely characterized by people on both the left and the right as an anti-immigrant racist. Donald Trump has repeatedly made comments and proposals about Mexicans and Muslims, about women and African Americans, about leaders in his own party, and of course about Hillary Clinton, that demonstrate a disregard for civility and a proclivity to speak to base fears and anxieties. And his rhetoric has emboldened many of his supporters to speak proudly with unflinching prejudice and bigotry. Racism is alive and well abroad as well. The Brexit vote in Great Britain, already being second-guessed by many who voted in favor of Britain leaving the EU, was premised in large measure on distrust and revulsion towards immigrants. So how does one contend with this kind of intolerance? How does a citizenry come to a consensus on public policies that reflect values of openness and inclusion? We begin today with a conversation about undoing racism. An organization called the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond has facilitators who lead workshops all over the country and abroad that explore the origins of systemic bigotry and the ways in which it can be overcome. Over the past few days, the Robert W. Deutsch Foundation, which concentrates its philanthropic work in the arts, has convened two groups of emerging arts leaders in Baltimore for 2.5-day workshops designed to understand how racism has become so fully ensconced in institutions across the spectrum of American life. Dr. Kimberly Richards and Rachel Ibrahim are with the People's Institute, and they are leading these workshops. They join me in the studio this morning along with A. Adar Ayira, who is the project manager for the More in the Middle initiative for the Associated Black Charities. She's also one of the driving forces behind Baltimore Racial Justice Action, which has ongoing programs that work against institutional oppression. Good morning to everybody. Thanks
Good
for
morning.
Coming in.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. So, Kimberly Richards, your approach to this very daunting task of undoing racism. This is a workshop that I've been proud to participate in these last couple of days, and we're going to finish up today. It's not about diversity. It's not about cultural competency. It's about undoing racism. How do you approach that problem?
Our approach, created by our two founders, Ronald Chisholm and the late Dr. James Norman Dunn, is one that's rooted in anti-racist organizing. We don't think that you can teach racism away. We don't think you can preach it away. But we believe that we undo racism by first understanding how the concept and the construct of race itself has been a dehumanizing process that oppresses all people, and it is a money-making engine that at the end of the day really robs us of what we as a human family can be. And so it's a process of us looking at what has been done to us as we work to do more effective anti-racist organizing.
And Rachel Ibrahim, that term organizing is very important here. This is not about training. It's about organizing. What's the distinction between those two?
Yeah, you know, it's taking education to a different level, and really, what does it mean when we partner with each other for the long run? What does it mean to really build a foundation of people who are committed to the same goal, to really walk the walk and talk the talk in action, building those networks that can sustain the work long term? Because it's really easy to push down one person. It's really easy to silence one person. It's really easy to fire one person. It's really hard to silence 100 people.
And Adara, you know more than a bit about organizing and training and the works. I mean, what is the approach of Baltimore Racial mm-hmm. Justice Action, and does it differ at all from, do you think, from the People's Institute?
So we have a lot of respect for People's Institute, and I was sharing with both Kimberly and Rachel that a couple of years ago, I participated in a People's Institute training on behalf of Baltimore Racial Justice Action to just ascertain the alignment with the model that we use. And it is very similar. Both of our models emphasize the institutional and the structural impact of racializations and their intersectionalities. You opened mentioning Donald Trump, and I think that that is such a great example because it is not so much one person or two people and their respective views. It is when those views gain a following and those views are inculcated into policy, impacting the lives of the rest of us who have to live in this country, that it becomes an issue. And so that, I believe, is what both of our organizations, their national organization and BRJA, which is locally born and works locally with communities and institutions, that is what we share in common.
And Kimberly Richards, the whole construct, the whole notion of race, we talked a lot about this yesterday in the workshop, is this, it's really at its heart a fiction, isn't it?
Right. We define race as a specious classification system that was really created to produce the types of outcomes that every one of our systems and institutions produce. And, you know, to categorize people in a way that says one is the ultimate, the model of humanity, and others are less than human, produces the fact that there isn't one system or institution in this country where Black people and other people of color are not at the bottom, be it healthcare, be it employment, be it education, be it infant mortality or adult mortality, be it the criminal justice system, that we are overly represented in each one of those institutions. So it causes us to either organize from a framework that says something is fundamentally wrong with us as human beings, which we don't believe, or our institutions are producing something that we have to look at both internal to us as human beings and at the foundation of those institutions.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. That's Dr. Kimberly Richards. She's here in the studio along with Rachel Ibrahim. They are both with the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. We're joined as well by Adar Ayira from Baltimore Racial Justice Action. So, Rachel, the terms black and white and language is such an important part of the work that all three of you do. But the terms black and white, you talk about how they are dehumanizing to everybody.
Well, the language, you know, is we don't walk around being like, yes, I'm these labels are not things that we chose, right? These are labels that have been put upon us, and all the labels, I'm thinking about even the terms Hispanic, not being language that was decided upon people of the Caribbean, of Latin America, of saying that these are the terms that I want to be called by. So we explore all language, and I think that's really important aspect of the workshop is how do we get a clear understanding of what are we actually talking about? What is the language that we are using and using interchangeably that actually is not the same thing? So when we say race, we think we're talking about bigotry and acts of hatred and individual meanness and not really talking about what is the systemic factors. How is this institutionalized? And so having common language, a shared understanding of what we're talking about is essential.
And Adar, language is so crucially important. Mm-hmm. You know, before I was white, I was Italian. You know, mm-hmm. other white people are Spanish or Irish or something. Mm-hmm. Before you were black, you know, you were from specific parts of Africa or the Caribbean or wherever. I know that Baltimore Racial Justice Action also takes issue with the term people of color. What's the reason behind that, and what is the alternative? How should we be talking mm-hmm. about this?
Thank you, Tom. So it's not so much that we take issue with it. It is that we recognize the ways in which it strips respective people of their histories and lumps them together. Our model really emphasizes the historical perspective of this country because all of this operates within a very specific and historical context. And most of us are unaware of that context. For instance, you talk about how white ethnics lose their ethnicity to become a part of, as part of the wages of or the price of stepping into whiteness, that we don't talk about Italians. And if you go back into a lot of historic documents, you will find that white ethnics were identified as English, as Irish, as Italian. And then that changed in seceding census. The only term in a census, just speaking historically, that has been consistent is the term white. From 1790 and even before, people were identified as white. No other group in this country, no other people of color, quote unquote, has the term identifying them been consistent or in many instances been chosen by them. The term white was chosen by white people in the country to pull together and to unify the different white ethnic groups. So having that historical perspective is extremely important in understanding how we got here today.
And Dr. Richards, we're going to be talking more about this after a break for the news. But before we finish up this part of the conversation, is racism unique to white people? I mean, is it possible for a person of color, for an African-American or a Latino or an Asian-American to be racist as well?
Well, I think it's really fair for us in this conversation and the listening off audience to, even before that question is answered, to really look at what is our shared definition of what racism is. Because as Rachel said earlier, this construct that this nation is built on depends on, one, us not having a common language, a common definition. And so we use a lot of words interchangeably with races. So some of the words we use interchangeably is bigotry, prejudice, discrimination, hate. What are some of the other words?
We normally associate it with people like skinheads.
Skinheads, right. Mm-hmm. And so we really think it's fair that before that kind of statement would even be made, what do we understand even the concept of race to be and racism to be? And when we really have that common language, which is one of the principles we organize with, so maybe when we come back from the break, we could talk about what are anti-racist organizing principles as opposed to just organizing principles.
We will do just that. Great. That's Dr. Kimberly Richards. She's here along with Rachel Ibrahim from the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. They are co-leading workshops this week in Baltimore on undoing racism. Those workshops, by the way, are about to finish up today. They will be back in Baltimore, and we'll post a link to their website so you can catch the next one if you're interested in attending. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, my guests this morning are three women who have vast experience as anti-racism and anti-oppression trainers and organizers. A. Adar Ayira serves on the board of Baltimore Racial Justice Action. She's director of programs at the Associated Black Charities here in Baltimore. Dr. Kimberly Richards is an organizer with the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, as is Rachel Ibrahim. The People's Institute has given workshops all over the world on undoing racism. Dr. Richards and Ms. Ibrahim have been leading two workshops here in Baltimore this week with emerging artists and arts leaders, and I've been delighted to have been invited to be part of that. So, Kimberly Richards, let's pick up where we left off before we broke for the news. How do we define racism?
Well, even before getting to defining racism, it'd be good to really look at what are the values of an anti-racist organizer. And as Adara said earlier, one of our key principles is learning from history. That, you know, we many times in this nation, as young as we are, when we think about the world, we really don't have a strong sense of history and what it took to create a nation built on the idea and the ideology of the concept of race itself. So one of our anti-racist organizing principles is, how do we learn from history? Another one, and how do we learn from the fact that we are a nation built on that ideology, is a second principle. The third one is, how do we really understand and celebrate the culture of all peoples? That, you know, we use terms like people of color, we use terms like diversity, but we really don't examine whiteness. and what the history of that concept and construct is. So as anti-racist organizers, it's important for us to really understand and be guided by, in all the work that we do, those three principles, as well as the concept of leadership development. How can we really, as a group of organizers, develop leadership and develop relationships that are accountable? Because as Rachel said, in my organizing, I'm really more intensely and intimately beginning to understand the difference between mobilization and movement. Because when we mobilize, it's really around bringing a large number of people together for an event, you know, and it's a lot of, and many times it's about a head count. But if we're talking about a movement, an anti-racist movement, it means that we as a group of folks who really want to make a difference are all on the same page about how we've been socialized, how we've been programmed, how we've been conditioned, and how the very concept of race itself is a man-made concept to produce the outcomes, again, that every system and institution in this country produce.
Yeah, Adar, I hear this morning there's a report on NPR about how the level of arrests, the number of arrests of, again, people of color, for lack of a better term, African-Americans and Latinos in particular, in Colorado has remained very high for drug possession, even in a state where in which marijuana is now legal. But there are still some people operating in the non-mainstream economy. And again, the arrests of people of color much higher than white people. Another example, it seems, of, you know, institutionalized systemic racism. What can individuals do when Kimberly Richards talks about mobilizing in a movement? How can individuals affect what's going on systemically in the criminal justice system, in the housing system, in the banking system, et cetera?
I think that the first thing that we can do is educate ourselves about what is happening and the historical underpinnings of it and how all of that impacts us today. BRJA has workshops going on multiple times a year. We hold 13th of the month events. They're called 13th of the month events because they are every 13th of the month, regardless of the day that that falls on. And we talk about issues like that, Tom. We talk about criminalization of African descendants and other people of color. We talk about how the systemic and institutional racism impacts life's choices and chances in higher education, for job opportunities, in every single aspect of society. Coming to events like that, and the 13th of the month events are free. So coming to events like that does a couple of things. It not only educates, but it affords people an opportunity to meet people who are actually doing some aspects of the work, whether that is facilitation or trainings, whether it is acting as organizers and resistance fighters within their particular spheres of influence, whether it is just building and connecting with a learning community where they can grow and they can look at their own stuff. But Kimberly was talking about the ways in which we are all socialized and inculcated, and we all have our own stuff to look at. Looking at that stuff and connecting with the community and the ongoing education, those are great places to start because they equip us to take action.
So, Rachel Ibrahim, I spoke a couple weeks ago with the head of the African American Studies Department at Emory University, a fascinating woman named Carol Anderson, who wrote a book called White Rage, The Unspoken Truth About Racial Divide in America. And she says that one of the things that happened was that this, the notion of racism was defined by white people to mean the members of the KKK or the, you know, the jackbooted cops in Montgomery, Alabama in 1965. And it created this kind of, she calls it a cloud of innocence over white people, because they would look at that and say, oh, that's not me. You know, I'm not a racist. This is something you've dealt with very personally in your life. You are a mixed race, of mixed race ancestry, with a white mom and stuff. As Dr. Richards talks about defining whiteness, how do we do that? And what does racism mean in the context of that?
Yeah, it's a that's a complicated one. I identify as a mixed race black woman raised in a white family in a white community, I think one of the things I don't know if I'm going to actually directly answer that question, but I am going to say that what's important is for white people to understand that they have been racialized, because oftentimes that it goes unsaid as though being white is the norm, even if we don't say white is normal. So even being able to say who is American and who is African-American, who's Asian-American, but who's American, it goes implicitly, you know, it's implied that it's white people. And so being able to name that, you know, folks are white is essential, and it's not enough. And that we know that because of the way in which white people have been socialized, you know, there is a way that white people play out different manifestations of whiteness, and how that can look in terms of, again, normalizing one's experience, universalizing one's experience, actually keeping disconnected from the way in which other how folks of color are actually experiencing the world, very distinctly different.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. I'm joined in the studio by Adar Ayira from the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, as well as Rachel Ibrahim and Dr. Kimberly Richards from the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. We're talking about undoing racism. Dr. Kim, you mentioned the various areas in which people of color have constantly been, you know, put to the bottom of the hierarchy. Let's talk about healthcare, for example. What do we do when we know the history of bias and bigotry, prejudice, racism in the medical community? We talked yesterday in the workshop about the Tuskegee experiments, those horrible experiments that ran from the 1930s through the early 1970s, in which they injected African-American men with syphilis and did this incredibly unethical study, and it caused all sorts of death and pain and horrible consequences for these people. So we know that. Medical community knows that, and they will tell us that they have reformed, that they have, you know, fixed that, that they've figured this out. I was very surprised yesterday when you in the context of talking about Tuskegee, you said that you've chosen not to immunize your children because it seemed to be because, you know this history going on in the medical field. And on the other hand, you know, the health commissioner of Baltimore City would tell you that that's medically not advisable. How do you reckon what's happened in history, and how do you know that we've made any progress moving forward?
Well, one of the things, Tom, is I think it's important because it's not just the healthcare system. As we look at every system in this country that you can determine someone's outcome based on their race, what those institutions have done is just lobbed race off of the agenda. So the healthcare system says health disparities, but those health disparities are racial and ethnic health disparities. The education system says the achievement gap, but it is a racial achievement gap. The child welfare system says disproportionality, but it is racial disproportionality. The juvenile justice system says disproportionate minority contact, but it is racial and ethnic disproportionate contact. So if every one of our systems that have an inequity that is based on race, and we don't say that, then if we don't call a thing, it will continue to exist and thrive and then take the focus off of the institution. So when we look historically at the relationship, and I don't have to say a lot to Baltimoreans around the relationship that the healthcare system has had to our detriment, where we have been the guinea pigs. You know, I've read the Henrietta Lacks.
This is the home of Henrietta Lacks.
It's the home
Lacks,
of Henrietta Lacks.
Yeah. And there remains an enormous distrust of the medical community among peoples of color
here
in Baltimore, even though we have some of the greatest medical institutions in the world. Yeah.
Because our bodies have been historically and continue to be specimens for institutions to experiment on, to test on, and to profit from. So yes, I chose not to immunize my sons because I had information. I took responsibility that I thought was important, and I'm a licensed lay homeopath. And my sons, who are now 30 and 32, are extremely healthy. They have not had any issues. They've traveled the world.
But that decision was premised, excuse me for interrupting, that was premised in knowing what has happened in the past.
Yes.
So you're not confident that any of that has been resolved as we speak now.
I'm confident in listening to my gut bone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm confident in listening to my mother wit. I'm confident in listening to the stories that my mother and elders in my community, you know, in the South. I'm originally from Mississippi, where I currently live. You know, in the South, a lot of Black folks don't say the hospital. We say the horse pill, because our health care was provided by veterinarians with the animals. So we have, you know, and in our current history, Mount Sinai Hospital did a test on Black and brown children to see if we had a gene for criminality. So, yeah, my decision was made with information, you know, and a commitment to being the best mother and the most responsible mother I could be of three African-American sons in a community, in a nation that sees them on sight as criminal and sees them on sight as to be not trusted.
Thank you. I've been dying to get into this component of the conversation. Every time when we say, don't you see progress, we take our eyes off the fact that regardless of whether there is progress, there still is racialization that negatively impacts our communities. It also takes the eye off of the need for organizations like People's Institute, like Baltimore Racial Justice Action, like Associated Black Charities, and the work that we do around the Moore and Emito Initiative, where we delve into the racializations and the negative economic and health outcomes for African descendants because of institutional and structural racism. It is this type of work that so desperately needs to be done, because the progress that we have made within the context of continuing in racializations does not matter. We can move toward the goal of an anti-racist equity society, but we cannot say, well, because there has been progress, that is the main thing that we should be talking about.
There are so many things that we should be talking about. We have run out of time to talk about it this morning, but I am very grateful to all of you for joining me this morning and having this very interesting conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom, for the time that
Appreciate
you spent.
Thank you, Tom. Dr. Kimberly Richards and Rachel Ibrahim from the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, and A. Adar Aira of Baltimore Racial Justice Action and the Associated Black Charities. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, local author Jessica Anya Blau has a new novel. She'll tell us about The Trouble with Lexi.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. My next guest is a Baltimore-based author who's just published her fourth novel. Jessica Anya Blau has set this one in an elite private school in Massachusetts, where the protagonist, Lexi James, works as a counselor. Lexi has overcome more than a few hard knocks, and she's engaged to a great guy, and she likes her job. And then, to put it mildly, stuff happens. The book is called The Trouble with Lexi, and Jessica Anya Blau joins me in the studio. Hey, Jessica, good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about Lexi. What attracts Lexi to you?
I mean, she makes some huge mistakes, massive mistakes, but I think the thing that attracts me to her is that we all make mistakes, and the best people I know have made massive mistakes. So I think she's human, and I think in a way we all have to look at ourselves and think that everything is possible, the good and the bad for all of us.
Is she based on anyone in particular?
Maybe me, but I haven't done some of the things she's done. I've certainly thought about them, and I tend to imagine the worst in every situation. I always think I'm about to die. I can't get in the car without thinking I'm about to get hit by another car. But I think my neuroses has prevented me from getting into too much trouble, and it doesn't stop her.
That's interesting because, you know, often writers do write semi-autobiographically. I mean, your first novel called The Summer of Naked Swim Parties, right. That had a lot to do with your childhood and stuff.
Right.
I was a little scared to think that this might be autobiographical, partly because there's a lot of sex in this book.
Right. But, you know, I mean, I have had sex. You probably have
too. Good for
you.
Yeah, once or twice. Yeah.
The book came out yesterday, so I haven't heard too many reactions yet. But the few reactions I've heard already, people are talking about the sex. And I actually didn't realize that there was a lot of sex.
Well, it's not like you're describing every caress or anything. But you know, I quit smoking 30 years ago. And reading this book, I wanted to just lean back and look at the ceiling and have a few puffs, you know, on many occasions. So, but we learn something about people when we sort of know what they've got on their mind. And Lexi has sex on her mind from the first sentence of the first chapter.
Right. And also when we see people have sex, I mean, as you said, there's not a play-by-play.
I don't see a whole lot of people having sex, just to be, I mean, when we read about people having sex.
Right. And when we go into their internal lives, I mean, the sex scenes are really, you're seeing it from inside her mind. I mean, it's what she's thinking and how she's processing it. You're not seeing the play-by-play of what goes where or what body part is where.
Right.
And so I think when you put someone in a situation like that, when you take off their clothes and then even push them against another human, you see who they authentically are, or you see their internal life. Like, you can't be faking it with yourself.
Jessica Anya Blau, her new book is called The Trouble with Lexi. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You set this in a private school in Massachusetts that has some Baltimore names attached to it. I wonder, is a private school with a bunch of sort of rich white kids, is that a setting that's rife with intrigue and, you know,
absolutely,
stuff going on?
Yeah. I mean, I think when people are living together and they eat their meals together and they sleep under the same roof, you have drama. I mean, look at a family. And a private school is sort of a family, but with people from all over the place. And in this private school, it's people from all over the world.
The first book that you pitched, the one I just mentioned, The Summer of Naked Swim Parties,
right.
You told a great story when you were first on the show about how you sort of came up with the title before you came up with the book. And you
right.
pitched this to an agent, and the agent said, oh, that sounds great.
Right.
And then you had to race home and write
and
a
write
chapter.
It. Yeah, yeah, it's true.
All four of your books now, or all three at least, I mean, maybe not this one, but the first three have been optioned for television and movies.
Right.
And there's such a great writer community here in Baltimore, and you're very much a part of that. That's something that all of these writers around here and everywhere really aspire to. What do you think it has been the magic touch for you to be able to market these past just the book form?
I don't really know. Maybe it's because they are very autobiographical. The second one is entirely autobiography. The first one is based on it. And the third one is when I was a student at Berkeley and I happened to end up working for a cocaine dealer accidentally. I didn't want to be working for a cocaine dealer.
These things happen.
Right, but I was. And this one is the most not autobiographical, except for emotionally, in her core, she's me.
Do you write them cinematographically? I mean, do you write them thinking, oh, this would be a great scene in a movie?
The way I write is I see a movie in my head and I write down what I'm seeing. So I'm seeing it happen in my head. I'm talking out loud the entire time I write. I'm saying the dialogue out loud. I'm saying every character. I'm doing their voices. And I see it running like a movie. And I do gestures, too. I mean, if my husband's around, he's constantly looking at me and laughing because if I'm having a character do a gesture, I do the gesture as I'm typing it. So I'm sort of inhabiting the people and acting it out.
Are you a plot grapher? Or
what,
did you start with Lexi? Here's this person. She's, you know, in her early 30s. She's teaching this private school. She's a counselor. Do you say, okay, what would that kind of person do, you know, in the course of a day, a week, a month?
No, I start with the person, and I usually start with them at a moment of crisis. I mean, the first book, it was keyed by a memory I had as a little kid, watching my parents at a naked swim party and one of their friends jumping on the diving board naked. And I was a little kid, and seeing that was like,
that would be seared into the imagination of any young child.
It was right? terrible.
Doesn't sound good.
It was terrible. It was like things are flying, and it was like, what? So that book just started from that single memory. And the next one, my mother had a heart attack and was supposed to die. And the next one started from the single memory of being in the hospital room with my brother and my sister and my dad. And we were laughing so hard we were crying. And you know, and she was supposed to die. But she She's a very funny woman. And with this book, it actually came from a story somebody told me at a reading I did in Washington, D.C. You know how Washington is. They had all this security there. And he said, we have somebody who just came out of prison. We're a little concerned, but we're on it. And we have people following him. We're going to be on him right away. And so then, you know, I'm at this event with all these dressed up Washington people. And somebody comes up and says, I think that's him over there. And they're showing me a mugshot of a guy kind of beat up and the person over there. And I looked at the guy over there and he looked just like Ryan Gosling. I mean, this guy was incredible looking, and he's in this suit, and he looked like a movie star. And I thought, that's the guy that just got out of prison? I thought, well, I have to talk to him. Like, why? You know, I mean, not that you can't go to prison when you're good looking. I'm sure it's filled with great looking people. But it did make him an interesting person.
And the whole thing about, you know, you never know who's incarcerated or for what reasons.
And you don't know people's backstories. You can't look at somebody. You don't know their internal life.
So you saw a handsome ex-convict.
A handsome guy who just got out of prison. Right, who chose, who paid money to hear me talk at a dinner in D.C. So I went, you know, talking to him, and I thought,
if you don't get a book out of that, you won't get a book out of anything.
But I thought, I have to find out why he's in prison. So I, you know, I tried to get to it, and eventually he did tell me. And the reason he was in prison is he was addicted to drugs, and he went and he stole drugs. But the problem was, is he took the drugs in the house where he stole them, and he fell asleep on the bed where he stole the drugs. And just that image alone started this book.
Yeah, that's the very first page of the book, essentially. Yeah, that's
right.
All right. Well, I hope your life continues to be as eventful as it is so that you can have a fifth, sixth, and seventh novel. Always good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Anya Blau, her latest novel is called The Trouble with Lexi. She'll be appearing tonight at the Enoch Pratt Library along with fellow Baltimore author Matthew Norman. He'll be speaking about his new novel, We're All Damaged. That event starts at 6:30. We'll have a link to details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday, a conversation about the Baltimore City budget with City Council members Helen Holton and Brandon Scott, and our movie mavens, Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday. Get us up to speed on summer movies, particularly the ones that are being released to counter the summer blockbusters. That's all coming up Friday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.